Welcome to the Texans Talk Podcast. I'm Mark Lane. You can follow me on Twitter at The Real Mark Lane. Joined as always by John Crumpler. You can find him on Twitter at John H. Crumpler. Follow our work at The Texans Wire on Twitter, and always set TexansWire.USAToday.com as your homepage, and continually hit F5, because that always helps us. Joining us on today's podcast is none other than two-time Pro Bowler for the Houston Texans, Jonathan Joseph. When you think of great cornerbacks in the history of the Texans, you immediately think of number 24. Jonathan, thanks for joining us.
Oh, no problem, man. Thank you guys for having me on, Mark.
Hey, man, we're excited to have you.
Yeah,
glad to be on, my man.
Yeah, so what's it like having an off? Well, it is the off season, but you don't have to train. You don't have to worry about any of that stuff. Is this when you start to feel the itch that you wish you were playing again? Just how do Junes and Julys treat you these days?
Man, honestly, now I'm kind of running behind my kids, you know, different activities that they're involved in. That's pretty much taking up most of my time and my weekend, you know, trying to make sure they're up to speed on whatever they're involved in. Then at the same time, you know, having to be there for my wife, you know, try to, you know, go visit my mother and things like that. So it's really just, you know, spreading my time out and just using my time wisely. But honestly, man, I haven't got the itch at all. You know, when you talk about working out and training, I understand what it takes to be an NFL corner, NFL player in general. So, you know, me, I know in my head that I haven't put nowhere near the work in to even have a chance to step on the field. So I don't even have a thought in my head of going back out there at all.
Well, Jonathan, I'm glad you're happy with your decision, man. And you said there that you know what it takes to be a corner. Let's start there. What qualities do make for strong NFL corners? What do you have to play in this league?
I think first and foremost, you have to have short-term memory. I wouldn't say that first and foremost, but I think that's a big quality and trait. It's something that when you first start playing DB, people tell you, you know, that, and it don't really hit home until you get to the NFL when you're playing against guys that's better than you at times, faster than you at times, and different things like that. You know, have all-pro quarterbacks throwing the ball, Hall of Fame quarterbacks. So there's going to be times when you get to the NFL where you're going to be surprised how often you can get beat. So if you don't have a short-term memory in the NFL, it could start off as a train wreck, depending on what situation you're in. And I think you have to be coachable and being able to be adaptable because, you know, hey, you don't want to be like a guy that's pigeonholed. I can only do this thing here. I can't play this style of defense. So I think because, you know, the turnover rate in the NFL from head coaches to coordinators to coaches, playing style, techniques, and schemes. So I think, you know, just having those qualities and being tough, physical, obviously you have to be able to run mm-hmm. and play in the NFL. So I think having those different traits right there make up just what you look for when you go out to scout these guys because they all can play, but it's guys who can do those little small things and having a hard work ethic, being able to show up, you know, day in and day out and block out the distractions of being a professional athlete and everything that come with it on the outside.
Is there any moment that sticks out to you from your career where you talk about that short-term memory where maybe you got beat, but the next time you came on the field, you made a big play and you kind of exhaled?
Yeah, it happened a few times. But one time that I think about specifically, we was playing the Pittsburgh Steelers at home and had a young guy, Mike Wallace. And they was backed up like on the maybe the one-yard line, two-yard line. And I know damn well I shouldn't be up there messing around. And they had Mike Wallace up there. And obviously I'm fast, but Mike Wallace is fast too. And that's one of those moments that I'm talking about. So I trusted my speed a little bit too much. And everybody knows Ben Roethlisberger is a gunslinger. So he kind of caught me by surprise and threw a 50-yard bomb on me. So the next series that I come right back out, we hold him to a field goal. And obviously I'm pissed. I know better. And Mike Zimmer is even more pissed. And, you know, I come out and, we run a blitz and I jump it. And Ben Roethlisberger, you know, obviously I pick him off and I run it back for a touchdown. So that was one of those moments just, you know, me thinking the game through and not just being, you know, a robotic corner going out there. They're going to be conservative, not take shots. Understand that most teams in those situations take shots and know my personnel. this guy's Mike Wallace. I should have did a little bit more research and read the scout report carefully.
Yeah, and that's just part of, you know, the game and everything. And I think I remember that. That was 2009, wasn't it?
Correct. Yep,
yeah,
correct.
Yeah, now that was an interesting game, not to be talking about the Bengals on Texans talk, but that was a particularly interesting game because that was one of those gritty, you know, took some defense and special teams, and then you guys beat the Steelers, and I think you swept them that year as part of winning the AFC North.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, going through a lot of that stuff over there kind of molded me to the guy and the player I was when I got with the Texans. You know, we had Carson Palmer, and when I got there, he was at the peak of his career. And I think, obviously, he had a few injuries, and we had to, you know, juggle quarterbacks at time, and that's when I got to play with Ryan Fitzpatrick and guys like that. So I understood what a strong defense it take and how you had to be mentally to go out there and take the field each and every time when you don't have your star quarterback or you don't have the quarterback up to par that can move the ball consistently or the offense.
Yeah, and you were, of course, a first-round pick for the Bengals in 2006, and the Texans, they made a similar investment this year, taking Derek Stingley number 3 overall. What do you see in Stingley that gives you optimism? Because it's one thing for us to talk about, well, he can play these various schemes, he's – here's his 40 times and all this stuff, but we're not cornerbacks. We don't really know. You can lend a lot of insight as to, you know, what you see in Stingley that should give fans optimism.
I think he's battle tested. I think he plays so well as a freshman. People hold him to that standard. And like I just said before, playing cornerback is a hard job. So now instantly he had a target on his back from other offensive coordinators, wide receivers want to, you know, make their name off of him to where the outside world had him put up on, I wouldn't say a pedestal, but, you know, Mount Rushmore of the cornerbacks. So he had to wear that throne and go through different times at LSU, whether it was scheme changes, coaches changes, losing some personnel up front. Cornerback, it takes a lot to be a cornerback to where, you know, if you don't have that pass rush all the time, hey, it's a hard job out there, extremely hard job. So just for me, seeing him go through all those different things and just knowing, first and foremost, the history of LSU with the cornerbacks, you know, from Corey Webster, Patrick Peterson, Morris Claiborne, you can go down a list of those guys and just look at how they translated into the NFL. And injuries play a different part in a lot of guys' careers here and there, but I think he's been able to withstand, you know, obviously the tough SEC and fight through injuries and come out there and play consistently throughout his career and be able to go out there and be like the player he was as a freshman and still come and get drafted as a top 5 guy. That says a lot about, you know, him as a person, a player, and his makeup and his mentality.
Jonathan, you played at South Carolina. Just how valuable was that experience playing SEC football to get you ready for the league like Stingley just went through for the past 3 years?
You know, he's going to get pushed daily in the building from in practice, going against guys on the other side of the ball. There's going to be a speed factor there. So you're going to know he's going to do that. They're going to compete in practice. And you're going to get the physical training that, you know, you want your player to come into the NFL and have his body ready and understand the work that he has to put in. So I think, you know, being in the SEC and obviously going out there and playing, you know, the juggernaut teams, you know, whether you're good, bad, you know, you Alabama or you one of the teams down in the bottom of the SEC, you got to show up each and every week and play. And I think being in that conference, it kind of molded me and had me ready to come into the NFL. I wouldn't say particularly start right away, which I was a contributor and started my first game, but it had me able to understand the speed and the precision of the way things happen. If you're out of place, if you don't be on top of your playbook, all the things that you won't look for and a guy that you invest in a top pick.
Yeah, and it just dawned on me. You were drafted in 06. So in 05, that was when Steve Spurrier, right? That was his first year?
Correct.
Then in 04, that was Lou Holtz's last year, right? So,
yeah, 04, correct.
Yeah, so you played for Lou Holtz. He always has these interesting phrases and everything in the media, like, you know, it's a like a coin flip is a 50-50 proposition, but more times than not, it comes up tails. Was he that way behind the scenes as well? Was he always had funny or insightful things to say?
Absolutely. He's like a father figure or more of a grandfather. You know, obviously I got there when he was later up in his years, but at the same time, he brought the same energy and the same wisdom to practice, to the meeting rooms, just the respect and the command that he had over the room. You know, some of the most respected guys on the team or some of the guys we thought was the toughest guys on the team knew that he was a no-nonsense guy. You know, we always called him Dr. Lou. And I think, you know, he kind of prepared me for life outside of football because he held us to a certain degree, the way to approach the game of football, the way to approach, you know, being a student athlete and what it took to be a student athlete. And I always, you know, talk about that with him. Because, you know, he's not the biggest guy in size, but he think he can knock over a mountain. And I think that's the confidence that he installed in his players. And I thank him for being able to have that experience with him for the year that I did.
Yeah, and if I'm not mistaken, I think his last game was South Carolina Clemson, and there was a fight either in pregame or during the game. And he said that it was only appropriate that his last game – at South Carolina would include, you know, some sort of scuffle with Clemson.
Absolutely. You know, that brawl there. And I hated to go out like that for that to be his last game, you know, because, you know, the last thing that he wanted is any type of altercation, anything like that, because he was a no-nonsense guy. So, you know, it's just one of those unfortunate situations that actually kind of, you know, stemmed from, if you remember, the rumble in the palace with the Detroit Pistons and those guys were the night before.
Yeah, yeah, I do remember that. Yeah, that was
– yeah, so everybody was all jumped up. Yeah, everybody was all pumped up, you know, crunk from watching that right there and just, you know, phone calls going back and forth, meet at the bottom of the rock, all this crazy stuff. So one thing led to another.
Before we get too far away from talking about cornerbacks, obviously a lot we want to cover with you, man. In 2016, you played across from A.J. Boye in what was a bit of a career year for him. He went on to sign a huge contract with the Jacksonville Jaguars. What changed that season that allowed him to put it all together when we talk about corners transitioning to this league?
I think A.J. has always been a player that he plays out confidence. And he's always been physically gifted. I remember the first time I seen him. After they do the little rookie mini camp and, you know, the veterans come in for OTAs and everything. First day I seen him, I was like, I've been around a lot of corners, you know, throughout my time. I was like, who is this guy? And then I was like, he wasn't drafted. They were like, no, he wasn't drafted. I'm like, why? And he always had those physical gills and tools, but it was always just a mental part of the game for him. He would get down on himself. You know, he would lose confidence at times and things like that. And, it was a hard time. I wouldn't say a hard time, but you got to think we had a very veteran team right there and we was top defense. So there's a lot of pressure coming in on them because instantly when you come in as a young player, you like the deer in the headlights because now you have to play up to the speed and play up to the level of everybody else and be held accountable to those same standards. So I think there's a lot of pressure put on him, but that's the way the NFL. And I think he excelled at it. He learned from it when he got his time to come in and step up in big moments. Or in any moment, whatever role it was, playing the dime or the third cornerback position before he got to the next level. He always came in prepared, worked hard in practice, and I think that was the biggest thing for him. He took a different mentality to practice. He approached practice every day, stayed after practice. He worked hard in the weight room, and he molded himself, and he fought, you know, different ways to continue to keep his confidence level at an all-time high. And that's kind of how that became. And for me, it was a pleasure to watch because, you know, a lot of people take credit for all his development and things like that. But I like to say I played a big part in it because I was just able to just talk to him and just, you know, more than anything, show him each and every day how to do it and the ways to do it.
That's a really insightful comment. Thank you.
Yeah. And that's, you know, part of why I think you've made such an impression on Houston Texans fans, and you've been a fan favorite throughout your entire tenure. You were there for 9 years, 2011 to 2019. What are some of your favorite moments from being with the Texans?
Man, honestly, I say this is, you know, winning the first playoff game. Obviously winning some divisions, you know, just being on the team with, you know, guys like J.J. Watt, DeAndre Hopkins, Clowney, Brian Cush, and Kareem Jackson, Arian Foster, Andre Johnson, you know, and I don't want to just start naming off guys because it's too many guys to know.
Oh, yeah, you leave one off and you're in trouble.
Exactly. You know what I mean? Antonio Smith, Connor Barron, Wade Smith, Dwayne Brown. You know, when I start naming those guys, the first thing I always get pissed about, how the hell we didn't make it far or get to a Super Bowl, because I've been on a couple other teams and I know several other guys have. So I don't like to dwell into that much. But my memory is just being playing with those guys and just kind of, you know, transforming the way the Texans was looked at throughout the NFL. I think we had some great runs, you know, obviously playing with Kubiak, then the Bill O'Brien era. So I think just my time with the guys on the field, locker room, the fan experience, training camp practices, there's things that you can't duplicate. So for me, I don't want to put one thing before the next, but I think just overall, just transforming the way the Texans was looked at around the NFL, keeping NRG packed with energy each and every Sunday, you know, those are great games to come to, whether we was winning or losing. You know, I think the team gave the city hope that we had a fighting chance to win each and every game on Sunday.
Yeah, let me ask you about that, because I remember before the 2018 AFC wildcard against Indianapolis, J.J. Watt talked about how, compared to the first playoff game against the Bengals, the 2011 wildcard, that throughout the city, it was like Beatlemania is what he called it. What was that? You know, what was the vibe of the city like heading into that first playoff game, recording a 10-6 season, first division title and playoff appearance in franchise history? What was that like, just the anticipation going into that game?
Man, it was crazy, because you think about the team we had there. You had a more veteran team on the offensive side of the ball, if you think from Andre Johnson, Kevin Walters. Arian Foster wasn't old, but, you know, he's established running back. Matt Schaub at quarterback, and across the line, you know, all those guys. You know, Chris Myers and those were veteran guys. Like on the defensive side, you know, Mario Williams, D'Amico Ryan, maybe Antonio Smith. But you had young guys like Connor Barron, J.J. Watt, Kareem Jackson, Bryce McCain, Glover Quinn, who are all young. I think I was a veteran guy over there at that time. So us going into it, we all had mixed emotions because, you know, those guys before put up in so much work to get to that moment. You know, previous years, 8-8 or whatever it may be, 9-7 and still don't get in. And then me coming from the Bengals having, you know, a chance to get in twice and not still get there and come over here and make an immediate impact. You know, emotion was riding high, but at the same time, we knew it was a lot riding on it because obviously Coach Kubiak and those guys, you know, coaches want to get new contracts. Players get contracts off winning season. So we wanted to go and excel. Me playing against my former team, I wanted to go in and show those guys that, you know, what they missed out on. And at the same time, do a great job for my team. So I couldn't go in and be too high where I didn't do a job. So that common factor right there for me kind of kept me at ease. But at the same time, the city was just electric because there was so much hype in the offseason from the signings, from the J.J. Watt training camp leading up into the season, him kind of, you know, making his name for himself, Brian Cush, all those guys. It's just Arian Foster and what they was able to do on offense. You know, it was a show to come in there and watch what they did on offense week in and week out. So it was just one of those things to where it was a fun ticket. You know, you got your money's worth on Sunday.
Yeah, and you mentioned J.J. Watt, and he really started to come into his own at the end of that season, which I think really speaks to what actually helps rookies, which is availability and consistency of reps, because he was able to take all of that and he wasn't interrupted. So by the end of the year, you know, he's already played, say, a college season plus some. So he was able to put it all together right on time.
Oh, absolutely. And he was surrounded by a great group of veteran guys, you know, whether it was from me and the guys we had in the back end. You know, Danielle Manning brought in a great presence, played in a Super Bowl before. So, you know, invaluable experience and just brought a toughness to the back end. And Brian Cush and D'Amico Ryans, you know, those type of guys. You know, just look at D'Amico where he's at now. So you can only imagine the leader he was then. And the guys he had on the defensive line, Mario Williams, a former number one overall pick. Connor Barnes, guy that brings energy each and every day. Antonio Smith, a guy that's just gritty and tough all day. And then you bring in Wade Phillips, just the genius type of guy he is, his mindset. Whether it's getting guys in the right position and the right schemes, or it's just getting guys at ease, just being able to play to where you're not in a hostile environment each and every day. But at the same time, JJ had Bill Kolar as a defensive line coach who didn't care about anyone said he was going to hold his room to the highest standard and coach those guys hard, push those guys hard in practice. And JJ was able to adapt to that because of, you know, what he'd been through early in his career before he got to Wisconsin and his upbringing being tough. And I think that just molded him, and he was able to see just the natural athleticism and just playmaking skills that he had, other than just being, you know, a natural defensive lineman or defensive end.
Jonathan, you're bringing up some names here that you were part of some awesome defenses in Houston. Would it be controversial to ask what year did you think it was the best defensive unit you were on?
The best. Oh, man. You put me on the spot.
Y'all had a couple. You had a few
but
years.
But I'll have to say, I'll say it's 2 years, I think. I'm trying to be fair. I'll say one of those years, my first three years here. And I'll say that because we had on defense a number of first round picks. We had me, Kareem Jackson, Danielle Manning was a second round pick. You had D'Amico Ryan, a second round pick, Mario Williams, first round pick, number one overall. Jason Allen was a first round pick. So we had about 7 or 8 first round pick guys. And then you transform that over into a couple years later. I think it was Jadeveon Clowney first year, where JJ Watt was at an all time high playing level. And we still had guys in the back end, me and Kareem Jackson, AJ Bouye, Brian Cushing was still playing at a high level. We still was a consistent top 5 defense. So I think those two runs there right neck and neck because we consistently gave our team and carried our team from a defensive standpoint. And I'm saying that to say if you put any of those defenses with a healthy Matt Schaub, we'd get at least to the AFC, you know, up there. And if you put any of those defenses with a Deshaun Watson.
You know, it's interesting you say that because I've heard Mark Vandermeer say that although 2012 had the best record at 12-4, 2011 was the best team, and they did get undercut by the Schaub foot injury.
For sure, because this one, like, Arian Foster is probably the most dynamic guy I've seen. And he was just, you know, he can catch it out the backfield. He can make people miss. He was an instant offense. And Andre Johnson is Andre Johnson. We had tight ends. We had other guys at the wide receiver position who's good on special teams. We had good offensive linemen. You know, Dwayne Brown, Derek Newton, Wade, Chris Myers, all those guys across the board. And then on the defensive side, we were stacked. So that team was loaded, and we had experience.
Yeah, and the experience when a quarterback has that, you know, it inspires confidence throughout the rest of the team. But whenever a team decides to go with a younger signal caller, you know, you got a little ambiguity there. So as a veteran, you know, who's been in the locker room and everything, and you've played with young quarterbacks, what do you need to see from a young QB to buy in and believe?
I think first and foremost, knowing his place, knowing why he's been brought there. You know, whether you're the number one overall pick, second round pick, third round pick. I think it's levels to all of it, and I think it's the job of the coaching staff to get that message across quickly as possible. You know, if you're the number one overall pick and you come in as a day one starter, however they, you know, trickle you in, whether it's slowly or put you in there from day one, I think it's your job to understand where that team is at right now. If that team has a strong defense that can kind of win the game for you, and you don't, if you have a ton of playmakers, you still don't have to go out and carry the team yourself. You still have time to understand and learn the game and just, you know, don't lose the game and put the team in the right places. So now when you do catch up, you can make that a long run instead of missing out early on in your career versus coming in and trying to make too many plays and losing games that you shouldn't. So I still think it's a developmental phase there for a young quarterback. I think understanding where you're at with your team, because it's more so about the team. Now, once you get up there, if you're Aaron Rodgers, Deshaun Watson, Tom Brady, Peyton Manning, those guys, to where you don't have to have a strong team once you get to that elite level and you can carry your team, different story. But early on, you look around on all those guys' team, those guys have veteran guys in key positions, great coaching staff that was able to bring them along, and they was able to excel with the team. Look at Ben Roethlisberger. Look at Tom Brady. All those guys young in their career who won Super Bowls. Look at what they had around them and how they developed their game also at the same time, playing with their strengths as a team.
For a position like quarterback where it is so confidence-driven, these guys have to believe in themselves if they're going to win games at the NFL level. Can that be something that's difficult for young guys to admit that they need to scale it back and they don't have to be the reason that they win games?
Well, I think they, and when you say that, I still think some guys overthink it, because – to win the game, you just execute the play. You don't need to be heroic. You know, so that can be you taking the time off to whether you can pick up defensive schemes better, understand coverages better, whatever it could be to speed up your process, you know, to where now your timing is on with the receivers and the running backs, the offensive line, and all those things that go into the quarterback position. Not necessarily saying that I want to take the ball and throw it down the field and take shots all game, because that's necessarily no quarterback does that anyway. They just operate the offense at a high level and understand every situation of the game. They're in tune of the game. They're basically the head coach out there and understanding all moments. So as quickly that you can get yourself to that moment and understanding key 2-minute situations, 4-minute offense, 3rd and long, 3rd and short, plus territory, understanding all those key moments, when we need to get a field goal, if the team trying to blitz to push us back out of field goal territory. As a quarterback, the top quarterback that I face, they understand all those situations because I understand how they're attacking me and I see how they're attacking me, and they're attacking me in those instances and trying to execute to get, you know, the best situation for their team.
I was going to ask, did you ever play differently? You talked about the different quarterback archetypes. Did that ever affect the chances that you were willing to take on the field based on how you felt about the signal caller, or was it always playing within what the coaches are calling for?
Nah, I'm just playing football, because at the end of the day, like I tell, you know, whether it's my son or just younger guys that I talk to or even other veteran guys, like we all overthink things at times. It's like, oh, okay. I'm with the Texans, right? We got Andre Johnson at wide receiver, or DeAndre Hopkins, whoever it may be. And whoever the offensive coordinator is, right? Those guys are going to come out in their formation. They're going to get their splits. They all do the same wide receiver drills. They all in the same meetings. So it's all going to be the same routes, the same things. Now, their skill set may change faster, bigger, stronger, whatever that may be. But all I'm looking for is what their splits are, what the formation may be, whatever I can get pre-snap that's going to give me the indication of what this play is going to be. Now, next level is I have to compete with whatever they bring to the table. Physicality, fast, strong, high catching radius, whatever that may be. But if that guy goes down, the same play probably going to get called next guy up. So I can't get caught up in a matchup. Now, if it's 3rd down and short, red zone area, go-to situation, must game winning situation, everybody in the stadium know where the ball is going to. It's no secret then to the DB either. Now I just got to win.
And you talk about those scenarios and everything. Do you think that but they've been working on them with throughout the offseason workouts, and that's kind of what's helped David Davis Mills and everything. But the defense that Houston's running is the Tampa 2, which was, you know, deployed in the early 2000s, had its success. Do you think that the Tampa 2 can adapt to today's NFL?
I think so. I think because it's different variations. I think first and foremost, you have to have a dominant front seven. You can't have guys that can't get to the quarterback in a Tampa 2 scheme in today's NFL because the quarterbacks are too good, running backs are too good in space. And I think it's just too much space on the field and stress on defenders if you're going to do, you know, that without pass rushers. I think if you have pass rushers, that speed the process up on everything. If you have longer linebackers with length, which those teams try to employ because they take up more space, quarterback has to put the ball over their arms. You have instinctive DBs that can make plays that's tough and physical and can play man coverage and switch up the scheme in different situations. I think it can be really successful. But I think it all comes back down to if you're going to do that, you have to have an offense that's going to be able to control the game.
Jonathan, so this year in the draft a few months ago, the Texans drafted some guys that suggest that Lovie Smith might be gearing up to change the defense. They took Jalen Petrie from Baylor, who stars in the star role that's really popular in a lot of defensive schemes right now. They took linebacker Christian Harris from Alabama, who he blitzes. This team was second to last in their blitz rate last year. What are some ways you think defenses are having success against today's offense and things that we might see Houston incorporate? When you watch, what modern schemes in today's game do you say, oh, that's really smart?
I think, and now that we're talking about cover two, I had a chance to play in Tennessee. And Tennessee is pretty much a predominantly zone team, zone. And but they do a good job of the way that they employ it. You know, they put a lot of time into scheming things up, putting guys in the right position. But if you look what Tennessee have done over time, they've built that pass rush up front to where now that zone cover three blitzing scheme looks a hell of a lot better now than it did 2 years ago. You know, because then when it's not getting there with zone coverage, you have to ask those guys who predominantly work zone all the time. If you have to get a stop, you have to play man coverage. Now, if you ask what the Texans are doing, they're getting guys that can come up there. If you blitz, they can react on the ball and make plays, come up, make tackles, punch out the ball, play multiple positions, disguise, blitz. And at the same time, if you ask them to play man coverage, you bring a guy from Baylor, all those guys can run and cover. You know what you're going to get from LSU guys. You know what you're going to get from an Alabama guy. So if you start to look at guys like that, you say, hey, we're putting guys that are smart, fast on the football field that can make plays. And I think we're simplifying it down for them and let them play fast.
Jonathan, we got to get out of here. But before we go, you've played cornerback. You mentioned that you have to have a short-term memory when it comes to dealing with the mistakes and everything. You know, a lot of people just through their lives, through the daily grind and everything, they get beat down and they focus on mistakes that they've made and so forth. Just what are some tips and tricks that you had to let it go and to get upfield and to get to the next play and kind of reset and not dwell on the negativity?
I always think, like, how is it going to help me? You know, like, if I just gave up a big play during the game, like, the moment that that happens, I understood. You know, I try to understand because you don't have much time in a football game. You know, obviously things happen fast. So I just give you a quick breakdown between the game and after the game if it's a losing situation. All right, I'll give you a great scenario. The Cowboys game up there, Dez Bryant on third or fourth down, if you remember.
Yeah.
I had my hand all the way in there on the ball, right? And we all know, you know, Dez Bryant, great player. Tony Romo, great player. We went all out blitz. And for me, a lot of times we play off coverage and kind of catch the man. But, you know, I'm like, I know, well, I don't want Dez Bryant to run a slant. He got a bigger body. I want to hold inside. But at the same time, I know I'm fast enough. So, you know, the play goes out and great coverage. Can't ask for better coverage. But instantly, you know, I thought to myself, like, why I didn't get my head around? Because I knew it was zero coverage and the ball had to come out when I knew it was a go ball. So I started to question myself and ask myself things like that. And obviously we lost that game on that catch, right? But at the same time, I go back and say, how many times have I been in moments to win the game or execute something or do it right? And at the end of the day, I have another game to go out and play next week and another job to do. So nothing stops right here. I can only learn from this moment and go on to the next, and hopefully in the next situation, I do a better job than I did now.
All right. Well, Jonathan, we really appreciate your time joining us on the Texans Talk podcast. And when I know during the season, when you do your promotions for the American Cancer Society, feel free to hop back on and we'll talk about that and just raise awareness for the American Cancer Society.
All right. No doubt, my man. I appreciate you guys for having me on.
Thank you for coming.
All right, no problem.
All right, so there he goes. Jonathan Joseph, two-time Pro Bowler for the Houston Texans. You've been listening to the Texans Talk podcast. Follow us on Apple, Google Podcast, and Spotify. And follow John on Twitter at John H. Crumpler, me on Twitter at The Real Mark Lane, and the Texans Wire on Twitter at The Texans Wire. All right, say it, John.
All right, have a great morning, folks.